tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So here at the monastery, we've begun the traditional period of the Vasa, which is the rain retreat according to the monsoons in Asia. And although it's not a kind of a period of full-blown retreat, because of the weather and the sort of realities of life in the Western Hemisphere. But we have stopped, and we're having a period of 2 weeks of group retreat, group practice. So that we're not having any work, or not any work projects. I mean, there's sort of work things that need to be done, but just basic ticking over. So that returning to the roots of meditation practice. One of the things that's helpful to do in terms of meditation is to remind ourselves to be present, to be inhabiting the inhabiting the body, really living with our experience, because sometimes one of the things that we do in meditation, not just in meditation, but I mean, it's a general way that we relate to experience, is we, and oftentimes, as if we're kind of observing something outside of ourselves or distant to ourselves, like if we're it's easy to sort of come like watching the breath or watching the mind, as if it's, somehow stepping back from it and being an observer. So as if we're observing it from a bit of a distance. But I wonder how skillful that is in terms of setting up a distance between our experience and a sense of self, a sense of me that is experiencing that. So I think it's important to, because we do, in so many ways, we prop up that sense of self, separate sense of entity, of me, or of things objectified outside of ourselves. And a lot of it's not really questioned, not really investigated. To really inhabit the experience of, particularly in the meditation, because that's when we have the time to sort of go into things a bit more deeply. But it, ideally, it should be affecting how our ordinary day-to-day experience as well. So that in the meditation and in our practice, really attending to that kind of being very closely with what we're doing, inhabiting it, experiencing it, trying to get a strong sense, feel for what we are experiencing. So often, you know, we put labels on things, use language, use words, and because we've got a word for it, we think we've understood it, or we think we've felt it. But you know, the word, say, anger is not quite the sense of the same, really being there with it, or desire. The word desire is not the same as really being there for it and getting a feel for it. The word happiness is not the same as really how we experience it. This is something that Ajahn Chah pointed out one time in terms of, you know, the kind of the universal nature of Buddhist practice, when he's saying that you know, particularly in response to how he could, he was asked how he could teach Westerners, and he said, "Well, it's not because he couldn't speak English, and especially in the early days, most of us couldn't speak Thai." And he said, "Well, it's not dependent on language. The Dhamma and the Buddhist teachings are not dependent on language." And then they gave the example of, you know, just having a glass of, you know, a glass of water, a glass of cool water. And, you know, in Thai you would describe it, "Oh, that's a, you know, nam yen." And if you hear that in as a Westerner, you say, "We don't understand what it is." But then every language has got its own sort of word for it. French or Indian or Chinese or whatever. In English we call it, you know, cool water. And if you, you know, by pointing it, describing it through language, then you might not understand what it is. I said, "But all you need to do is just stick your finger in it, and you know immediately what it is." And so that's the language of Dhamma. It's the language of experience. And particularly the experience of suffering and freedom from suffering. So that all of the different experiences that we have, and particularly in meditation, you know, we're quick to label it, quick to put words on it, but do we actually understand it? Do we experience it? Do we inhabit it? Are we really present for it? So that, in terms of our meditation, really learn how to be present for the breath, know how to inhabit the body, inhabit the experience, inhabit the mental states that we're experiencing. Don't just skip over them with a cursory sort of look. "Oh, I'm watching this particular feeling," or "I'm watching the breath." Because it's easy to skip over it and then miss what it can teach us. We need to, you know, we really need to learn from this practice, you know, what is it that leads us to a place of suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent, and what is it that can lead us to a place of freedom? And if we don't penetrate things, if we don't see them clearly, then you know, we just keep skipping over and going on to the next thing. And the next thing is either, you know, something that we're desiring after and thinking that that's going to satisfy us, or we're running away from because we think it's going to be painful for us. So that's the general pattern of our lives, is, you know, chasing after the desirable and trying to avoid the undesirable, the unwanted. So that whether it's sort of wanted or unwanted, to learn how to be present for it, learn how to experience it, inhabit it. You know, even say like a, you know, when we think about our meditation, or when we're asked, well, how's your meditation going? Oftentimes we say, today was a good meditation, or is it? Oh, today was just really bad meditation. Well, what's a good meditation and a bad meditation? Is getting what we want is a good meditation, and getting what we don't want is a bad meditation. Whereas, in reality, the kind of quality of it is not so important. But what's important is the being present for it. Because even something that is, you know, a kind of a meditation that's completely filled with restlessness and irritation or distraction, if you're really willing to be present for it, really willing to just be patient and clear and really feel, what's that like? Where does that come from? You know, we start to learn from it. We start to be able to explore that. And, you know, we'll, quite naturally, we'll want to be seeking a way out. I mean, that's one of the things that the Buddha pointed to or said is that there's two results of suffering. One is more suffering, and the other is search. So that if we're really, if we're not really present, then suffering just sort of leads to more suffering, and keeps us spinning. Whereas it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. In that, if we're really attentive, if we're willing to explore, willing to learn from that, what comes up is a, you know, a real desire for finding a way out, a search for a resolution to that, a search for peace, a search for freedom from suffering. So that to be willing to, you know, willing to inhabit our experience, to allow our meditation to be an exploration, rather than it being kind of an expectation, sitting waiting for peaceful mind states to arise, waiting for insight. So and allow it to be an exploration, allow it to be a learning. And we can only do that when we're willing to be present, to inhabit our experience, inhabit our bodies. We begin with that, of just being willing to inhabit the body. Ground your experience in the experience of the body. It's a tangible anchor for our practice. And with the breath, that's the See, that's kind of the go-between or the negotiator between the body and the mind. And really paying attention to the breath. Really inhabiting the breath. Allowing it to settle in to the body. Pay attention to how the breath is coursing through the body, how it's either relaxing the body, how the rhythm of the breath, the nuances of the breath, whether it's smooth, whether it's ragged, whether it feels tense or whether it feels relaxed, whether it feels expansive or whether it feels contracted. And feel that in the body. Experience that in the body. Because that's, I say that as the breath is, that will be more or less how the mind is. I mean, it's a good indicator, it's a good mirror for helping us to see the mind more clearly. And then to be willing to inhabit the particular mental states, feelings that arise, thoughts that come up. And then recognize their quality. If their quality is one that is starting to spin the mind out, and come back to the breath. Allow the breath to be something that helps to soothe, to relax, to settle, to stabilize. So that there's this movement between the body, the breath, and the mind. So allow them to communicate with each other. Allow them to influence each other. Particularly, influence in a skillful way, in a clarifying way, peaceful way. And so often the tendency is to should be trying to. Trying too hard to make the mind peaceful, not in the sense of trying to stopping thinking, trying to make the mind still. And if we try too hard, then I mean there's a tension there, and it's going to lead to agitation. And allowing that sense of a bit of movement, you've got the boundary of the body, the mind, the body, the breath, in the sense of establishing awareness at that point. If there's some movement within the thought and feeling, don't worry about that too much. Because the more able we are to relax and feel comfortable, the thought processes, the feelings, they'll settle down on their own. But if you're pushing them too much, they're not. They don't want to. Allow the attention to be exploring within the realm of our experience, and, as I say, of the body, of the breath, and then the content of the mind, feel the tone of the mind. And as it's exploring that, and it's still within a within a sphere of of mindfulness, of awareness. So it's going to settle on its own. This one at tea time, where one of the things that came up in conversation was the role of Yoniso Manasikara, which is translated in a variety of ways, wise attention, skillful reflection, wise consideration, attending closely. I mean, there's, but it's a really important quality, because it's not one that's we hear about so much. Mindfulness, wisdom, you know, they tend to be talked about more often. But the role of this wise attention, the Buddha put a lot of weight behind it, in that in one discourse the Buddha compares it to in the same way that if one saw in the eastern sky the light starting to change, and it's starting to, the dawn was breaking with this, the light changing, turning red. One would have the confidence that, the new day was dawning, the sun was coming up. So in the same way, when Yoniso Manasikara, wise attention, is present, one can have the confidence that the Eightfold Path is arising within one. It's this path that's leading to the end of suffering is arising. So it plays a very crucial role, actually, in integrating the different factors of the path, how mindfulness, effort, concentration, wisdom, virtue, how they work together, how they function together. Because then one needs to attend to things in the proper way. In that they, that it, attention that is, and the word itself has a descriptive quality, and say manasikara is attention, the ability of the mind, stay with or to attend to a quality. But the yoniso is like the, is meaning sort of going to the root of things, going to the source of things, going to the birthplace of things, going to the womb of experience, because yoni is the womb. So it's like really going to the heart of things, the center of things, so that when we attend to things closely, really going to the heart of the matter, the center of things. That's when a major shift takes place. That's when we are starting to really get on the path. So to attending to things in a way that is bringing us in line with the Dhamma, in line with truth. There's many different ways of doing that. One of them, like using the attention that we pay, the mindfulness that we cultivate, the settled quality of the mind, to bring attention to characteristics of things. Their impermanence, their unsatisfactory nature, their non-self nature, anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is a characteristic of experience. That when we attend to it, when we pay attention to it, it helps to cool the mind or settle the mind, turn it to relinquishment and letting go. Now that attending to the impermanent nature of the breath, it's the change that takes place, both just, one looks at an in-breath and an out-breath. I mean, it's changing right there. But then, even within the beginning of the in-breath, middle part of the in-breath, the end of an in-breath, it's changing all the way throughout. And if even you take, the more you break down experience, the more you see it's changing its uncertain nature, its instability, the flux. And then you turn that same kind of attention of seeing flux and change and uncertainty, you see that it's the same for the body, the nature of the body, the mind, mental states. You see, we have thoughts in the mind. We have inspired thoughts, sort of idealistic thoughts. And I think, now my practice is really getting good. Now I'm getting it. And then it changes. And we're disappointed. And we completely forgot to that close attention, wise attention, wise consideration, that's actually its nature. That's its characteristic. Whatever thought we're ever having in the present, going to have in the future, it's going to be impermanent. It's going to change. We have some completely sort of nasty thought, or depressing, or negative, doubting. And, we think it's going to be there forever. Practice is hopeless. I may as well give up. Completely forget to apply that wise consideration, yoniso manasikara, that this also is impermanent. It's changing. It's uncertain. It's in flux. It's just a thought. It's just a feeling exactly the same. We sit in meditation and experience physical discomfort, pain in the knees or pain in the butt. You get discouraged and fed up with the meditation. Or these days we're sitting in up on the platform in the forest. And a mosquito comes along. And I think, end of the meditation. meditation is completely compromised because one mosquito comes along and wants it, one tiny little drop of blood. Or we spend the meditation just sort of waiting, not really actually having a mosquito come, but spending in trepidation that it is going to come. And it's just a feeling. It becomes so overwhelming. You forget to apply that yoni so manasikara. Thoughts, feelings. Perceptions, consciousness, the whole range of what comprises our experience is just that. It's just something that is impermanent. You know, and it's not to sort of blow it off or dismiss it. You know, so it's all impermanent. But it's just being willing to look at it from its characteristic, its tendency, in order to not be, say, deluded by it or infatuated by it. It's just that. And when you can say, oh, it's just that much, you can really be present for it. You can be really allow yourself to explore it. You know, what does it feel like to have a mosquito bite you? Mm-hmm. And you do that, and you say, well, it's no big deal. It arises, it passes away. It's sort of the expectation, the trepidation, the fear, the agitation that comes from not being present with experience, not being willing to inhabit it, not being allow it its characteristics to display itself, you know, the impermanence, the unsatisfactory nature of the dukkha. And it says a characteristic dukkha. This is unable to, you know, dukkha can be expressed in different ways. I mean, it's often, you know, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, but it's that inability for any physical, mental phenomena to be stable, to sustain itself, to completely satisfy. So both on an emotional level, it's unstable, but then on a physical level, it has these conflicting forces of causal forces within it that are within itself. There's this instability and unsatisfactoriness, and it tends to undermine sort of real true well-being, true peace, true happiness. So that seeing that characteristic, it doesn't mean just resigning oneself to sort of unmitigated endless misery, but it's really being able to let go of that reality of the characteristics of things and realize that there's a refuge somewhere else. It isn't in the experience. It's in the knowing of it. It's in the clear seeing it. It's in the letting go of it that we find peace. And it isn't as if that is sort of completely, you can't sort of capture that and make that stable and consistent. It's within that willingness to be present that we find a refuge of peace. So that, and then that recognition of non-self, and that there's that tendency of the mind to recreate or try to create a sense of me within experience. It's me who is experiencing happiness, me suffering, me who's good, me who's bad, me who's successful, me who's the failure. Why all that me in there? That when we're willing to inhabit experience, we can recognize, you know, that me is a projection, that sense of I, that central core of what we feel, of a self, I in there, is created, it's projected. And what is actually there is experience arising and ceasing. And we can realize that. And that's in the Buddha's teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the cessation of suffering, the freedom from suffering, the experience of Nibbana is something that we can realize. It can be realized. It's not just a hope for something that takes place, you know, sometime maybe after we're dead, or is bestowed upon us by somebody, something else. It's something that we can realize. That's the beauty of the teachings, and it's the challenge of the teachings is that it's put onto our plate that we have both the capability and the responsibility to realize that. And it's something that the Buddha said is possible for all of us, but it relies on our practice, our willingness to put these teachings into practice, to inhabit them, to really be present for them, to explore them. So I'll offer that for your reflection this evening.
Andamayang dhamma kataya sadhukarang dhamma se.